Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Xinchen Li, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
25% of Australians are already tuning into community radio every week, and further support for a vibrant arts sector really enriches the content.
We found out how the community media will benefit from the latest cultural policy. Also why the conflict between Israel and Palestine has escalated. And later today,
basically we need to understand what penguins are dying from and the seasonality of their death. And since then, and even before that, we were actually getting any dead bird that were found by members of the public.
The group is looking for volunteers to support penguin research. We will have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We are on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a new campaign was launched today by the Miners and Energy Union in Queensland demanding the state government to act on miners' injuries and death. The union wants the government to make mine companies accountable for these incidents. Since most of them were filed into court, there are no charges or the cases are indefinitely held up. The Wire's Edward Jordan asked the president of the Miners and Energy Union Queensland, Stephen Smythe, what the campaign is about.
Yeah, this is a campaign that's been in the wind for a little while now. The reason that's been is because we've been trying to manoeuvre and work through why when a worker gets killed at a coal mine, we've seen as no justice or no action being taken against the employer or those directly responsible. And, you know, we've tried every avenue. We continue to lobby government, and we just believe enough's enough, and that's why we've launched this campaign, Justice for Miners, because we're sick of the carnage. We're sick of seeing workers going to work and not returning home, but most importantly, we're their families and friends and not yet getting any answers. And are simply left in the dark, and we just think it's totally inappropriate. We think it's totally unacceptable, and we believe action's required.
Steve, so what are some of the main risks miners face when working?
The mining is hazardous by nature and involves a lot of dangers. We had the open cut in the underground sector, but in the underground mines, we had the threats and the real examples of a mine explosion. They work in dusty conditions. They work in areas where the roof can collapse, inundation by water, machinery, so they have a lot of hazards they deal with each and every day. And then in the open cut sector, they're very similar, but they face the risk of what we would call strata fire, where a wall could fail, material. They have vehicle collisions, they do a lot of blasting, they use a lot of mobile equipment that can go over edges, they have dust. So the list goes on. So mining in nature is hazardous. It's about managing the hazards to an acceptable level. And unfortunately, what happens is when a worker dies on the job, it's clear that the measures in place haven't worked or haven't been effective. And I think for a long time now, people have not, and I mean senior people and people within government, have not been serious enough about taking action against those who are directly responsible when a worker is seriously injured or killed on the job.
As you mentioned, miners have lost their lives or are severely injured because of work-related accidents, but it looks like no one is accountable for them. What do you think the Queensland government is enacting on this issue?
I have no idea. I am gobsmacked why action is not taken at the highest level. You know, we have a regulator who's there for enforcement and compliance. They do their part, but somewhere in between the part they do to where it goes to the workplace health and safety prosecutor to review the case back to the government, something's going amiss, you know, and to have cases simply dropped because of a clerical error, I find absolutely disgusting and disgraceful. And then to have other cases where families cannot get answers 3, 4, 5 years on, that's just totally inappropriate. And there's got to be a disconnect. This is a part of our campaign. We want more transparency. We want answers. The families want answers. The friends want answers. And more importantly, we want to see real action. We can't keep saying, oh, we have the world's best mining legislation. We have tough cops on the beat. Yet when something happens, they hit them with a wet lettuce leaf and there's no action taken. You know, it's just totally inappropriate. And 38,000 coal miners in the Queensland mining sector deserve better.
Besides giving answers and all that, what else would you like the state government to do to avoid deaths or to check accountability on the mines?
Yeah, well, I think the state government needs certainly beefing up the regulator. I know they're putting a new investigation unit in place and that, but I think and certainly believe that the government needs to beef up the compliance. They need to beef up the action they take. They have the capacity now to remove what they call statutory tickets in the coal mining sector of people who are senior management or senior people at the mine site, yet they haven't done that. So I think that there's stuff that they can do. And we keep hearing, oh, it's not in the public interest or it's under investigation. Well, you know what? I get that there's a process that goes through and we don't want to see anyone incorrectly or convicted. But after 3 or 4 years, surely there's enough evidence there to be able to take action. And that's what the government needs to do. They need to speed things up. They need to make sure they do it right. They need to make sure natural justice is applied. But at the end of the day, there's other action they can do, which we believe they need to kick into gear and do in a more efficient and quicker way so that families get answers.
And how can the community be involved with this campaign?
Yes, so today we launched our campaign. We have an online petition to start with. We have a website that'll be promoted and advertised through our social media pages, Mining and Energy Union. And also then, as a part of that, we're going to obviously ramp the campaign up in the public as well and through our network. So what I'm pleading with people to do is go online, read the information about what this is about, why we've got to this situation because of the tragedy that's occurred, and then understand that going online and signing is supporting these lost miners and their families and their friends to get change. And, I encourage people to go online and sign a petition as a start. I know it can be an upsetting time for the family and friends as this campaign may bring back, obviously, the sad memories. But, you know, it's about ensuring that what's happened in the past, those people are held to account to stop it happening in the future.
That was the president of the Miner and Energy Union Queensland, Stephen Smythe, ending the story by The Wire's Edward Jordan. This week, The Wire covered the announcement from the federal government about its new cultural policy called Revive. The policy will boost and empower the creative arts sector, particularly for the Aboriginal and the Torres Strait Islander community. But also, the community media sector will benefit from Revive, in a sector where 1 in 5 Australians listen to community radio. The Wire's Edward Jordan asked the CEO of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, John Bissett, his thoughts about the Revive.
I think it's fantastic. It's a fantastic piece of work, and the CBAA strongly supports the policy. It really offers a sort of direct support for community broadcasting and will strengthen the creative industry as a whole. It's the sort of piece of work that we've been hoping the government would do for a long time. And a really positive pattern of tangible support for community broadcasting by the Albanese government. And I think, look, that support has been shown through the last year's budget that provided funding certainty for community broadcasting. Parliament also recently passed some legislation to streamline licensing for community broadcasters, and the Department of Communications is reviewing some opportunities at the moment to even further improve the sector's long-term sustainability. So I think a really good policy that really supports community broadcasting and the sector as a whole.
How critical was the announcement of this cultural policy, you believe?
The announcement of the creative policy was a significant, essential step forward. It's been very well received by arts bodies, music groups, the arts community, community radio stations. And I think the establishment of Music Australia really shows the government has been listening to the industry, which has been calling on some of this sort of policy initiative for a while, and it really came out clearly in the consultations. It's a good $70 million investment in music creation, education and industry initiatives like the support for Sounds Australia. We're very excited to see that. And it's great to see that community broadcasting is also recognised as part of a broader cultural policy for the nation. I think when you look at community radio, 25% of Australians are already tuning into community radio every week, and further support for a vibrant arts sector really enriches the content that community broadcasters and community radio stations can put on air, and really the richness of the cultural experience for listeners.
How will this policy help and support community media besides in strengthening the sector?
Look, the recognition of the role of community broadcasting in the national cultural policy is important, and it's really what CBAA and the community broadcasting sector has been looking for or asking for. Community radio is a really important pathway for local artists, you know, especially musicians, and helps them find their audiences. You know, over 5 million people are listening to community radio each week, with 33% of those people listening in specifically to listen to Australian music, 35% listening to hear music that's not available elsewhere, like on commercial radio or Triple J or public broadcasters. So community radio really connects artists with their audiences. Some of Australia's biggest artists, like Gautier, Courtney Barnett and others, got their start on community broadcasting, not community radio. And the policy really offers, you know, an opportunity for increased support and increased funding from the government into the future.
And now, in which way will this policy support First Nations community broadcasters as well?
The cultural policy puts First Nations stories first, both symbolically and practically. The first pillar of the policy is First Nations first, and acknowledges that First Nations stories are the centre of Australian arts and culture. I think that's really, really important. It's put into practice with measures such as Indigenous Arts and Languages Program and efforts to first safeguard First Nations languages. They're also introducing legislation to protect First Nations knowledge and cultural expressions, and protect First Nations art as well. You know, 1 in 4 people that identifies Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listen to community radio every week, and it's, you know, it's estimated that community radio really provides access to First Nations arts and culture for up to 100,000 people in most remote communities across the country.
Now, as you mentioned, with 1 in 5 Australians listening to community media or going to community radio as well, do you believe this policy will start strengthening the community media sector?
Look, we're going to continue to work with government to make sure that community broadcasters are stronger and more successful. That's why we exist. And the first budget from the Albanese government really provided that funding certainty for us, with over $80 million allocated to community broadcasting over the next 4 years. And in addition to that, there's funding for First Nations media organisations as well. And we hope to see that particular funding grow significantly.
That was CEO from the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, John Bissett, ending the report by The Wire's Edward Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I am Xinqing Li in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM, to our listeners in Emmerdale on Toon FM, and to Tasmania on Edge Radio. At the beginning of the year, the conflict between Israel and Palestine escalated, bringing concerns of a third intifada. It's the first time the conflict has escalated after Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was elected back to government. The Wire's Edward Jordan asked a senior lecturer of peace and conflict studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. A.L. Merritt, his reactions about the conflict's escalation.
I think what we're seeing is not a new phenomenon. It's more like a continuation of processes and dynamics that we've seen before, that we've warned about months ago, well before the swearing in of the new Netanyahu government, but is now coming into effect, and the violence is starting to ratchet up.
So why did the conflict escalate at the beginning of the year?
There's a number of factors for that. I would say mostly a combination of radicalization on the Jewish side, which has manifested most significantly just recently in the strong foothold given to some radical nationalist Jewish elements in the new Netanyahu government. And then, and maybe more importantly on the Palestinian side, an increasing sense of what I would describe as hopelessness, which is frankly quite easy to understand. Almost 30 years ago, most Palestinians in the West Bank had agreed to forsake the armed struggle for independence, for a state. But decades have passed and they've received nothing in return. In fact, I would say they are much worse off today than they were then in terms of politics and their struggle for a state. So if you look at, you know, a number of elements that they are experiencing, an ongoing occupation that a lot of the Palestinians living today were born into, no prospects for Palestinian states in the near or midterm future, continued expansion of Jewish settlements, which establish facts on the ground that will make it more difficult for a Palestinian state in the future, fears of annexation by the new radical right-wing government of Netanyahu, and worsening, I would say, incidents of the daily human rights abuses they are suffering, mainly from Jewish settlers, but also from the Israeli army.
As you mentioned, you know, not a long time ago, Israel elected a right-wing government again, bringing Benjamin Netanyahu as a prime minister. But the interesting thing is about the colleagues surrounding him as well. So who's Itamar Ben-Gvir and his views on this conflict?
Well, he's certainly a character to be taken note of. He's a religious radical nationalist that today is no less than the new national security minister of Israel in Netanyahu's government. While on the opposition, he's been thriving on chaos, on disseminating of populist policies. He was a target of interest by the Israeli police for inciting violence. And now he's actually going to be heading some of the Israeli security services. And will have to try to implement some of his crazy policies, which is going to be very difficult for him because he's both inexperienced, but also his radical positions would almost inevitably, I think, lead to an escalation and violence between Jews and Arabs.
And what do we know about the lions then on the Palestinian side?
I think this was kind of subsided. We're talking about a number of small cross-factional armed groups, and one of them being the Lions Den. They've sprung over mainly the last year or so in the West Bank, mainly in the Palestinian cities of Nablus and Jenin. And initially, they've attracted much attention and popularity, both on the Palestinian street and around the world. But more recently, they've been suppressed quite aggressively by the Israeli army. Whether or not there'll be a continuation there and what part will they play in an uprising, if an armed uprising does occur is unclear, but yeah, something to certainly look at as well.
We know this conflict will continue for some time, and it's so complex on each angle, but are there any realistic options to solve the conflict, or at least to minimize the conflict?
Okay, that's a big question. I'll try to answer at least some of it. The question is, what will happen in the near to mid-term future? There's a number of triggers, if you like, that could lead to an intifada, to an uprising, an armed uprising, such as a trouble on the Temple Mount, evictions of Palestinian families from East Jerusalem, Israeli retaliation or punitive actions in response to violence by the Palestinians, mob attacks on Arabs. So there's a lot that can happen, but we don't know what will be the extent of an uprising if such happens, who will take part, what will be the level of violence, as opposed, for example, to civil disobedience.
That was a senior lecturer of peace and conflict studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. Aya Meres, ending the story from The Wires, Edward Jordan. A research from the University of Western Australia is seeking volunteers to help identify penguins in West Australian beaches. The project called The Little Penguin aimed to record any little penguins who are deceased and see if there's a seasonal pattern of their death. The Wires contributor from RTR-FM, Fiona Bartholomew, ask the research fellow at the University of Western Australia's Oceans Institute, Dr. Belinda Cannell, how the project originally came around.
Many years ago, I actually did a similar project, and I got people to walk sort of a range of beaches from Coburn Sound all the way down to Path Mandurah, and you know, we're looking for getting them to look for dead penguins there, because basically we need to understand what penguins are dying from and the seasonality of their death. And since then, and even before that, we were actually getting any dead bird that were found by members of the public on in a sort of an ad hoc basis or on either Penguin or Garden Island, and getting necropsies done to determine cause of mortality. And so from those data, we understood that, unfortunately, the most common cause of mortality are strikes by watercraft, so getting hit by boat or by jet skis or windsurfers and kite surfers. But we haven't done it on this regular basis, like regularly looking along beaches for a number of years now. So it's kind of like getting back into that, and then also determining, as I said, the seasonality of causes of mortality, and if some years are worse than others.
Yeah, and last year, for a year, you had people walk 1 kilometre lengths at least once a week. What was involved during these walks? What were they looking for?
Basically, they're just walking along, hopefully the high tide, depending on what time of the day that they're walking, but at the high tide level, and searching along that sort of between 1 and 1.5 kilometre section of the beach, looking for any dead penguins. And then if they note any other dead seabirds, they can let me know that as well. But basically, we're really interested in looking at the numbers of dead penguins that we're finding, and then if they're in a fresh enough condition, then we can actually get them necropsy to try to determine their cause of mortality.
If they did come across a dead penguin, would they call you immediately and you would rush down, or would they kind of place a marker for you to come later?
Yeah, look, one or the other. Or they can actually call the local rangers, either the council rangers or DBCA rangers, and then they can pick up the carcass and then get it from them. So the idea is that, obviously, the fresher that we can get it, the better, because once it starts decomposing, it's pretty hard to find out what the cause of mortality is. But thankfully, no one actually found any dead penguins last year, which was great. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's hunky-dory for the little penguins. They are sort of having some tough times, but it just means that none were actually, you know, dying within that sort of Coburn Sound area and then washing up on shore. They could still be dying, but not necessarily washing up the shore.
So how does finding dead penguins along the beach help with understanding their cause of death and a bit about their species?
We've been studying little penguins, well, I've been studying little penguins for sort of 3 decades now, so we know quite a lot about their ecology, where they're foraging, what time of the year they're breeding, when they're molting, what they're feeding on, a range of different sort of unique criteria that give us an idea of what these little penguins are doing. But one of the biggest things that we don't, or that, you know, that is really important, is what threatens these species. And it's not necessarily the same in every area. So what might be threatening the penguins here in Perth doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be threatening the penguins at Phillip Island, for instance. So, and it can vary from year to year. So some years we might have, in the past, we've had more deaths from starvation, for instance, than watercraft injuries. In 2011 and 12, which was sort of associated with the marine heat wave, we had a lot of dirt birds dying from a parasite called toxoplasma, which comes from cats. Now, that was really interesting because there are no cats on the islands, and so the only way that they can actually get that toxoplasma parasite is actually via cat poo going into the stormwater drain system, which then goes into the marine system, and then these eggs or the oocytes of these parasites then being taken up by the fish, and then the fish being eaten by the penguins, and then the penguins getting this parasite and dying. So, you know, it just shows us what can actually happen in the marine system and then how that might change from year to year.
So last year there were more than 300 surveys done during this year-long walking up the beach. Was there anything in that data that surprised you at all?
I think the fact that we didn't find any little penguins was quite surprising. Expected at least one or two. So, as I said, that's great that we didn't, but it doesn't mean that everything's rosy for the little penguins, for sure.
That was Dr. Belinda Cannell from the University of Western Australia. Ending the story from RTR FM's Fiona Bartholomeus in Perth. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening whenever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We will see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you would like to listen to any of our story again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional owners of the Turrbal and the Jagera countries where its program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I am Xinchen Li. Thank you so much for your company, and we will see you next time on The Wire.